Well, pleased to be here this morning, and thanks for the opportunity that makes that possible. I think I'm supposed to hit the arrows, is that right? Is that what Jeff found out? Okay, so what I'm going to do is to talk about two high throughput phenotyping projects that have they have several things in common, but they are all up close and personal to their plant targets. And as we sort of progress down the line, looking at sort of very detailed phenotyping and so forth, I think that idea of close proximity to plants is going to be one that will be shown to be of increasing importance. The first one of these is a large stereophotogrammetry chamber and field study of Arabidopsis, and then a highly wavelength resolved field study of Brassica rapa. Now, the photogrammetry methods, basically, I think many people are familiar with these. You have cameras from multiple angles. You identify common points in the respective field of view, and then by trigonometry, you can extract 3D information about the targets. There are, of course, a number of challenges in that. Lenses always have some geometric distortions, and also there are, if you're using color metrics to distinguish your plants, color balancing can influence your results too. And so what we've done is to put together a pipeline that incorporates a large amount of software to address some of these issues and develop our 3D models. The plants themselves are in chambers at UC Davis. We've got 1,050 of the Arabidopsis NAM lines. Does this work? Yeah, there we go. We're taking pictures from arrays of cameras every hour. Those are transferred electronically to the Texas Advanced Computing Center. Forwarded to Kansas. We use a tremendous amount of metadata for this. We have genetic metadata of what plant is in what pot, obviously. The images incorporate, we transfer into raw format, so they have metadata. We have a color scheme on the sides of each tray for human use and a dot encoding scheme to identify the traits visually. They come to KSU and then go through a series of steps that I'll describe here. The first is to correct the color and so forth, just to show you how much of an effect lens distortion can have. And remember, these are commercially available cameras. This looks like a picture, and when I put it in motion, that's what lens distortion removal does, and it's very clear. Color correction, again, it oscillates, and you can see that the real target is much bluer than what comes through in the original picture. We then run it into a commercial program called Agisoft PhotoScan Pro that makes 3D models. And you may wonder, why do we want 3D models? Well, we're measuring leaf characteristics, and you can see here in this animation, if you focus on the leaf where the arrow is, over the course of the day, hyponastic movements will change considerably the aspect ratio of that. And so we want to be able to correct for these kinds of movements in addition to growth and so forth. We segment, stitch together images of the plants, and then that leads us up to the phenotype extraction. Here are some of the data that we're getting. This is not a picture of a plant. It's actually a 3D model of a plant. And for each of the points in this leaf here, we've got 3D coordinates as well as a surface normal that tells in which direction that's oriented. And so we can therefore extract by adding up to triangle areas, leaf area, as well as leaf angle distributions and so forth. Now, measuring leaf length is more difficult because, of course, that leaf is curved, and I figuring out which path to follow through there involves a series of steps. The first step is to find the plant center, as you can see we've done for these plants here. And then, having found the center of a plant, we find basically the leaf tips. And knowing the leaf tip and the center, we can go back to the 3D model and then begin to trace the path length along the surface. Now, this is working pretty good, but you'll notice that in some cases, and this is particularly true in field plants, there'll be some little notches and added and sort of imperfections in the thing. And so where we are, our target for this week is to pick up a little bit better leaf smoothing so we get, you know, the right tip and not some artifacts like we're getting here. But, you know, basically that's the premise. We can use similar technology in the field. These are racks that we have in our field plots. This is a mobile by meaning two people lift it and move it, mobile, and we get the same, well, we say stabilized platform, so that sort of is like going to it. Now, this looks like a picture. It is not. That is a 3D model, and if I showed you the entire area of that frame, there are 45 million triangles in that area. And of course, then what we do is, it's an ultra high res 3D model. We pull out the individual plants, we segment them, and then we've got a little blue dots here that are like basically swizzle sticks that we can use to identify individual leaves that we might want to track, and do the same sorts of things. But now I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the other thing that we're doing, actually in the same fields as the Abrorhabdopsis plots that I just showed you. And these are highly wavelength resolved spectroscopy, or reflectance spectroscopy, in Brassica rapa. And here's we have many aims for this study, but I'm going to talk about just one of them today. If you look in the literature, there are a huge number of different indices that remote sensing folks have come up with. And by indices, what I mean is a formula, like NDVI is one of them we just heard about, where you plug in information on certain wavelengths and you calculate some hopefully meaningful number. In the real world, the values that you get in any sampling situation undoubtedly both reflect the genetic influences in the plant as well as those environmental influences that have acted over time to get that plant into the condition that it is, and that, you know, when you take the measurement. And so we were interested in looking and seeing if we could identify particular indices in which some of those genetic influences might be particularly strong. And so what we did was is that we started with published lists of vegetation indices, identified 53 candidates. From those, we selected a small number that all had in common in their formulas some form of sort of self-normalization. In other words, they were ratios or things like that as opposed to just absolute numbers. Then what we did was and I'll describe how we collected the data in a moment, but basically we identified those that were showing significant line effects or significant line by treatment interactions. And then we mapped those against a set of about 1,200 markers and identified a number that came up with significant QTL. The data taking method was that we used, we had 2 years of data. I'm just going to show you 2010 data here. We took that, took the measurements with a ASD's Field Spec 3. Each plant reading, and these go from 350 to 2,500 nanometers, was normalized at that instant by spectralon disk reading. So literally, we'd shoot the spectralon disk, and then we'd shoot the plant, and in that way, corrected for any kind of sky condition changes and so forth. Basically, we looked at 2,500 plants, so that's 5,000 readings with two treatments in a real panel. Here are the six that came up with significant QTL. I'm only going to talk about two of these, namely the PR2, which is very closely related to PR1. It's a phytochemical reflective index, and then NPQI, which stands for, and I have no idea what the Q is doing in there, but it's basically a normalized, I can't even pronounce that word, but I'll show you here in a minute, okay? All right. And so not only can I not pronounce it, but I don't know what the Q stands for. So who knows? Anyway, PRI2 and PRI1 are both well-known indices. They relate to photosynthetic radiation efficiency, and also depending upon which of the two you use, they also have a link to chlorophyll fluorescence. Now when we looked at, and I don't know if that's readable or not, but you don't have to pay attention to the whole thing. These indices are known to be related to maximum photosynthesis rates, stomatal conductance, and water use efficiency. And these kinds of correlations that we got here, sort of around 50%, are very well, you know, other people have seen about the same thing. However, interestingly enough, there is research that shows that if you correct these raw measurements for the bidirectional reflectance spectrum or distribution of the plant, which involves leaf angle and the way that light bounces off the leaves, you can dramatically improve those correlations. And so across the bottom here, this is from a 2008 study by Hilker et al. Here's photosynthetic efficiency on the bottom. Here's PRI. Raw data looks like this. You see a lot of scatter, but there will be, like I said, a correlation about in the same vein that we had. But once you correct it for BRDF, it looks like here there's a lot fewer points. Actually, there's not. The points are just all on top of each other. And you can get correlations that change from 50% up to even 85 or 90%. But you have to therefore use two kinds of measurements together to achieve that result. Now, the other one that I'll show you is this NPQI. And first of all, I just, for personal information for me, how many of you in the audience have ever seen a QTL with a LOD score of 14? One. Well, it was news. We hadn't seen something like that either. What it basically does is this index measures the relationship of chlorophyll A to, and there's different spellings of this, but pheophyton A. What that is that initially pheophyton was thought to be a degradation product of chlorophyll A, because basically the only difference between them is that it's missing the magnesium here in the chlorine surround. But it's now understood and is that it's actually the first electron receptor or electron transfer component in photosystem 2. So when you look at it, when you look in the literature, you'll see it referenced in context to chlorophyll degradation. You'll see it referenced in respect to various kinds of stress studies and so forth. We wondered if we could see any relationship between that index and the chlorophyll fluorescence measurements that we had also taken on these plants, but we weren't able to see that. And so we decided, well, you know, let's try it the hard way. Can we find any candidate genes under that QTL? And oftentimes you'll find 300 or 400 genes under a QTL, but this one is so sharp that we only found 48 candidates. I should tell you that the results I'm showing you now are exactly 30 hours old. Okay, so you can't ask too many questions. Okay, in the middle of that is a brassica gene that is a homolog of one in a that's known in Arabidopsis, and that one controls the ratio of two flavonoids, myrcetin and kempferol, and it's known from Arabidopsis that particular gene is very sensitive to ultraviolet. And now, if anybody who's ever worked at Laramie has probably learned personally and the hard way that there is an abundance of UV at 2,100 meters above sea level. Okay, and so we're wondering if we have found a brassica sunshade gene. And like I said, 30 hours ago, we didn't know any of this. Okay, now, and there's obviously a lot of work that needs to be done to establish that. But one thing we can do, and it's actually being done as I speak, this graph, which we found in a 1982 study, shows absorption spectra for kempferol, and the green and the red lines were the two wavelengths that were used in the NPQI index. And so what we're doing, because we've got this high-resolution spectral data, we're going to go back, make our own index that picks up that peak versus the red, and then see just if by chance we can enhance that LOD score even higher. Don't know if the seminar was later and the symposium was later in the week, I could tell you what the answer to that was going to be. But in summary, what we've done is that we started off with two superficially unrelated phenotyping methods, 3D models from images and these highly resolved spectra. And yet what we're finding is that one of them, such as basically the 3D spectra and leaf angle, or 3D knowledge of leaf angles and so forth, can help us increase the resolution of one of our indices. And although it might be, there's a lot of work to be done, and even if we get a positive result, it'll be serendipitous, it could easily be that this UV gene, if that's what it is, helps plants have leaf angle distributions under UV environments that, might otherwise be damaging. Even if, whether or not this sort of next to last point works out, I think the moral of the story, however, is clear. What we cannot be doing in these programs is focus on, hey, let's build a tractor and put this sensor on it and this sensor on it and this sensor on it and this sensor on it. What we have to be doing instead is thinking of how the plant processes interrelate and how we can put together complexes of sensors where some of them offset, the strengths of one offset and complement the weaknesses of the other, and in that way begin to really collect data that through the inverse modeling process that Jeff talked about can really hone us in on what's going on in those plants. So at that point, I will stop. Yes, right.
So, sure.
Those are both. Those are both good questions. So, in the Arabidopsis chamber study, we're collecting 330,000 images. Okay, there is absolutely no way on earth that any human being is going to look at 330,000 images. So that pipeline is automated from one end to the other. Okay. The cameras work automatically. The data transfers through TAC into Kansas are automatically automatic. All the programs kick in sequence to do that. And 5 terabytes goes in at one end, and when we finish a few little wrinkles, a spreadsheet will come out the other end. Okay, some number that you can look at. All right. The importance relative to your second question let me back up one thing. One thing that we've learned out of that automation process is that you have to build in tremendous numbers of cross-checks. Metadata resolution, I didn't talk about that, but we've got different streams of metadata that all have to come together. Now, how that relates to the field studies we're talking at plot level, some of the same things occur in the sense that we'll have large numbers of images and or other types of data. The lesson is that we're going to have very good metadata cross-checks to make sure everything is registered geographically correctly, and that, you know, and like if you do drone flights, how do you get the pictures from the drone to be the same, you know, thing is on, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And so those lessons carry across. Some of the segmentation issues can be the same if you're looking, you know, because you've got plants. If you're doing this right, you're doing plants through their life cycle. You're not just going out there one day where you've got a closed canopy and doing it. You'll be taking young plants and so forth. At those young stages, they will be separate plants. And so that part carries over as well. Does that help? Okay.
Any other questions?
What was the spatial resolution of the help for paper for the DRDF direction? Because it makes a big difference if you're using satellite data or.
Yeah. They were doing. That was a forestry paper, and it was not. I don't believe it was satellite overview. Or overflights, but I would have to go back and check that. I'm sorry.
That's another question. Computationally, for computer capacity, I noticed you were feeding data to some Texas network somewhere, mm-hmm. computing center. Is this stuff really, really computationally demanding, or if you take these data sets to somebody who works with this kind of stuff, they just go, yeah, no problem, it's a piece of cake. I mean, how close are we pushing the limits?
Some of the stuff, well, for example, it just highly depends on the number of images and so forth that you've got, all right? One experiment that we tried, we had I think it was Soteria plant standing there in the wind. We went around it with a camera, video camera. In a minute, or a little over a minute, we collected 4,800 images. And that, number one, that was going to take 250 hours to process on a desktop computer. And number two, it wouldn't produce the answer because even in the 60th of a second, the wind moves the leaves too much. Okay. I think that some results will be within the reach of a well-equipped lab that maybe has a computer, you know, some kind of computer cluster in it. I think campus clusters will be playing extensive roles in this, and when we really talk about if we're going to go out and do 20,000 plots, that's going to have to be done on larger systems. Fortunately, supercomputing, the NSF-supported supercomputing centers, their usage is free to investigators. There's an allocation process, so it's rationed in effect. But for example, at TAC, you can apply a two-page application and get 50,000 CPU hours just to try out your stuff. Okay. So it spans the scale, but yeah, we're going to be hitting that high end.
Any more questions?
With the spectral work, can you use the hyperspectral scanner to do that, or are they just not going to be fast enough? I mean, you're unmixing a point signal.
Scott, I'm not quite sure I'm following. So the one that we used was a point measurement.
Yeah, no, I mean a hyperspectral 2D camera.
Oh. Where I See, that's a really good question, okay? Because what is kind of going through my mind at the present time, and I might change my mind in 6 months, is that the merit of the hyperspectral camera is that you get an image in addition to all those spectral readings, okay? But I think that we're going to find, you know, hyperspectral cameras are kind of like, you know, really sexy. Everybody would think, oh, that's cool. I think there's going to be things that we can do with just, you know, sort of the ocean optics types of spectral radiometers once we find out which wavelengths to look at, okay?
Any more questions? Thank you very much, Steve.
Okay, thank you.